in English and rhetoric at USC. He lives in Los Angeles now. He tells me his PhD studies are on 16th century rhetoric, which would be a whole other morning, I'm sure, and beyond. And he is also the founder and main organizer, I assume, of Mormon Review, the new review about literature in Zion currently. And I'm sure he'll tell you more about that, and you may wish to pick up some of that information. John Binion comes to us very bravely and loyally today from the Brigham Young University, where he has been an English professor for 3 years. He's also the author of a most delightful book, Breeding Leah and Other Stories. So it's my pleasure to introduce now to you Gideon Burton, who will be followed by John, and then we'll hope to have some comments and questions from the audience.
Could I see that from John's book?
Oh, sure.
Thanks. Good morning. Thanks for coming. Literature, in its broadest definition, has already proven to be crucial in the building of Zion. After all, Mormonism began with a book. Mormons have gained their very identity in reference to it, and the church has survived and prospered as much by a flow of ink and paper as by the flow of revelation from the heavens. Mormonism has spread and sustains itself through the written word, printed revelations, missionary tracts and discussions, written sermons, conference reports, defenses of the faith, pamphlets, newspapers, chronicles, histories, periodicals, diaries, journals, hymns, teaching manuals, handbooks, etc. Martin Luther said the Protestant Reformation would have been impossible without the printing press, and we may well say the same about the Mormon Restoration. 1992 alone saw the distribution of 4.8 million copies of the Book of Mormon. And if we consider the amount of printed material produced to administer to and teach both investigators and members, plus the volume of books and magazines sold through independent sources to the Mormon public, we can only nod assent in recognizing the debt that we have as a church and as a culture to literature, to literacy, and to the entire phenomenon of minds and texts colliding. But this is using the word literature in its very broadest sense. Does literature have a role in building Zion when it is considered in its more restricted, conventional meaning? What about novels and stories, fiction, poetry, drama? Are these merely ornaments to the more substantial activities of kingdom building? After all, Zion is a very serious enterprise to Mormon people. Doesn't the dubious content of so much of literature present an obstacle rather than an aid to the creation of a perfect society? Just how is it that we can rationalize, for example, the reading or writing of fictional stories, say, fictional stories about a pig or something like that, when our real-life stories remain unrecorded for posterity? These are important concerns, and no doubt Mormon objectives and values sometimes provide solid grounds for opposing the reading or writing of literature. But can the reading and writing of literature be yoked into Zion's cause? Well, of course, I'm going to stand up here and tell you that it can. But unless we carefully consider the true extent of Zion and the means we have of arriving at it, and unless we can conceive of the study and production of literature in more than missionary terms, we will not be able to fully access the transformative power of literature both for ourselves and for those beyond the Mormon culture. Well, what is Zion? Zion is a very curious concept to Mormons because it names several things. It's the name of a spiritual state of being, the pure in heart. It also indicates crucial, if remote, episodes in sacred history. Enoch's city of the distant past, or that apocalyptic metropolis yet to be established on this, the American continent, although not likely within Bill Clinton's administration. A sort of emerald city in the American Midwest, but impregnable to the floodwaters of Gentilism, a refuge for the elect. Zion also indicates a Mormon socioeconomic ideal, the actual application of the law of consecration and stewardship, a successful culmination of the many 19th century Mormon experiments with the United Order. The spiritual, historical, and economic aspects of Zion are certainly at its core, but Mormon prophets and early church leaders envisioned a Zion society not strictly in terms of its economic egalitarianism or spiritual unity, however important that these may be. To them, Zion meant the acme of human civilization in its broadest, most complete sense. the renewal of world culture at large. Zion was to begin with pure religion, but was not intended to stop there. It was to be the ideal society in every aspect, and its establishment was the goal to which the entire restoration was oriented. I want to revive this vision of Zion. Not only does it stir the soul, but it leads us to realize that the panoply of gifts and talents provided by the Lord are all required in that glorious composite of unity and diversity that will be Zion. And literature finds its place securely in this vision, alongside art and other impracticables that just may be worth doing. Orson F. Whitney has eloquently articulated the vision of Zion that he inherited from Joseph Smith. Quote, "God had designed, and his prophet had foreseen, a great and glorious future for that people. He knew there must come a time when Zion, no longer the foot, but as the head, the glorious front of the world's civilization, would arise and shine, the joy of the whole earth, the seat of learning, the source of wisdom, and the center of power, when side by side with pure religion would flourish art and science, her fair daughters." Close quote. After pondering the grandiose dimensions of Zion outlined in these words, I fear that many of us today may be trapped within an overly narrow vision of Zion, as though the only thing flourishing there would be sugar beets or homespun wool. To hear Orson Whitney, there may just be more to consecrate to the kingdom than surplus zucchini, once we envision Zion as the glorious front of the world's civilization, as renowned for learning, art, and science as it is for religion. It's within the context of this high vision of Zion that Whitney provides his famous patriarchal blessing to Mormon letters. Quote, "We will yet have Milton's and Shakespeare's of our own. God's ammunition is not exhausted. His brightest spirits are held in reserve for the latter times. In God's name and by his help, we will build up a literature whose top shall touch heaven, though its foundations may now be low in the earth." Close quote. This stirring prospect for the future of Mormon literature comes from a speech by Whitney called Home Literature. I'd like to explain the significance of that title. For 3 decades prior to this speech, the saints had been anxiously engaged in establishing what were called home industries. These ventures were part of the many united orders being organized in the last decades of the 19th century and were intended not only to give economic independence to the saints, and not only to build spiritual unity among them, but to establish an ideal society in all its aspects. The United Order organized by Lorenzo Snow at Brigham City, for example, included a broad variety of home industries: a tannery, a water-powered woolen factory, a millinery shop, a tailor shop, group farms for raising vegetables and grains, a horticultural industry that oversaw the cultivation of orchards, vineyards, flowers, and shrubs, and silk and cotton industries, complete with an orchard of mulberry trees for silkworms and a satellite cotton plantation down in St. George. There was a machine and maintenance department that included a blacksmith shop. Milk, butter, and cheese came from a cooperative dairy. Pigs ate the dairy refuse, providing meat, as did the sheep. Departments were set up to construct private and public buildings, including sawmills. These included a brick and a lime kiln, and carpentry, masonry, and architect departments. There was a furniture and cabinet department, tin and pottery shops, rope, broom, and brush factories, a greenhouse and nursery, a public works department to construct roads, bridges, and irrigation projects, and even a tramp department, which gave handouts to itinerant hobos in exchange for menial labor. But Lorenzo did more than set up home industries that saw to the saints' physical needs. In his own words, "A religion or system is of very little account where it possesses no virtue nor power to better the condition of people spiritually, intellectually, morally, and physically." Close quote. The scope of Zion building was never solely on the physical plane. Not only was one of the chief home industries of Brigham City its public school system, every bit as essential as the brick and adobe shop, but there is important evidence to suggest the high priority Lorenzo Snow allotted to the cultural improvement of the Mormon people, even in the face of pressing physical necessities. When Lorenzo Snow arrived at Brigham City in 1854, it was quite an ugly place. There was nothing around but an old insect-infested fort, a few adobe huts, and some scruffy vegetation. But he paused long enough only to set up some decent housing before he then turned his home into a community center where he sponsored socials, theatricals, and debates. First things first, the other home industries could wait. And as they grew, so did Lorenzo's cultural projects. The Dramatic Association of Brigham City was soon organized and flourished for years. The role of literature and the arts in this expanding society was more than clear. So, in 1888, when Orson Whitney provided his defense of literature entitled Home Literature, he was not alone in singing the merits of a literary education and calling for a tradition of Mormon writing, all in the name of Zion. He was following suit to the efforts of Lorenzo Snow, Brigham Young, and others who assigned to education and cultural development a role in building Zion as crucial as the ironworks or wool factory. Mormonism, said Whitney, is not only the gospel of truth, but the gospel of intelligence and culture. Consequently, when Whitney impresses upon young saints that they are on the threshold of the mightiest mission ever given to men in the flesh, we must understand that mission means more than simply proselyting for the Mormon faith. It embraces the larger mission of the restoration, of which the restored church is but one part. The restoration did not simply mean authoritative priesthood power and the structure of the primitive church brought back again. Rather, the restoration comprised the very renaissance of the world and its culture. And to continue citing Whitney, it is by means of literature that much of this great work will have to be accomplished, a literature of power and purity worthy of such a work. Now, I don't mean to imply by this that Whitney did not think that the growth of Mormon literature would provide a good proselyting tool for the faithful. He certainly did think that a Mormon literature would serve a Mormon missionary purpose, for example, like Parley P. Pratt's Voice of Warning pamphlet. He saw literature as a special means for Mormons to let their light shine to the educated world, a vehicle for attracting others to the faith. And I'm sure that the missionary motive has always figured into any official encouragements by the church for the development of the talents of the members. Take, for example, President Spencer W. Kimball's words from his famous Gospel Vision of the Arts speech. For years I have been waiting for someone to do justice in recording, in song, and story, and painting, and sculpture, the story of the restoration, the reestablishment of the kingdom of God on earth. Close quote. I'm certain that were President Kimball living today, he would congratulate Keith Merrill and all others responsible for the impressive film Legacy, now showing at the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. It celebrates through film the story of the restoration, just as President Kimball had desired, and is doing impressive PR work for the church at their newest visitor center. But art meant to glean converts to a cause usually rubs artists the wrong way, and a few audiences as well. While I do not believe it is impossible to mix good art and true religion, there are all kinds of dangers at hand as soon as we see art serving only an advertising role for the church. But happily, Orson Whitney envisioned another, perhaps more important role for literature in Zion building, one quite distinct from missionary work. It is a role that ties in nicely with the teachings of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and the aspirations they had for the development of the Mormon people overall. Rather than being something Mormons produce in order to advertise Mormonism, Whitney described literature as something they experienced in order to grow and develop as human beings. Literature means learning, Whitney asserted, giving it an important educational, not just a proselyting purpose. In his discussion of literature, Whitney outlined what I call Mormon literacy, an approach to the reading and writing of literature in light of the restoration and its purposes of redeeming not only individuals, but the world's civilization. If we are to redeem the world and its culture, we must engage it and its ideas, growing as individuals and as a people in light of both the gospel and the world beyond our little valley of understanding. To Whitney, literature did not mean just a static body of texts that would persuade others to become Mormons. Rather, it constituted a vital and legitimate means of perfecting the saints. Now, the demographics of today's church are quite different from those of the 19th century church in more than just numbers and geographical distribution. The early saints were not generally from the educated middle class, including Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. It is little wonder that their conceptions of the growth of the Mormon people included intellectual growth, not just greater numbers or greater material self-reliance. After all, as Hugh Nibley explains in reference to the early converts, these new saints were put to work on a grandiose intellectual project, quote, nothing less than the salvaging of world civilization. Literature might be something educated. Clearly, education did not mean merely the acquisition of facts to our early leaders. It meant becoming intellectually acute. It meant discerning, discussing, debating, and distinguishing. Zion citizens, said Whitney, would be as famed for intelligence and culture as for purity, truth, and beauty. Joseph Smith knew that his people must progress, that their destiny demanded it, that culture is the duty of man, as intelligence is the glory of God. Close quote. I wonder if we take seriously the idea that culture is one of our duties as saints. As a very practical bunch, we tend to act much as school district administrators during a budget crunch. The first things to go are the art and music programs. We'll just keep whatever math and reading will help people function on a basic level. But Zion has never meant to function on just a basic level. We do not sing the hymn as functional Zion. We sing beautiful Zion. Have we forgotten that we are building a civilization fit to be inhabited by angels and gods? For Zion must increase in beauty, said the Lord to Joseph Smith. Zion must arise and put on her beautiful garments. We are here, said President John Taylor, to beautify Zion and have pleasant habitations and pleasant gardens and orchards until Zion shall be the most beautiful place there is on earth. Zion shall yet become the praise and the glory of the whole earth. Close quote. The fact that Zion has been conceptualized by our prophets as a place of beauty gives a place for aesthetic concerns in our culture, of which literature is a part. In our temples, such as the recently completed and magnificent San Diego Temple, we have allowed marble to replace cinder block for one place of worship, and this makes more than passers-by on the freeway take notice. Temple worshippers themselves feel the union of the spiritual and the beautiful as they together radiate the spirit sought in that holy place. The same must hold for what we create with words. Unless we learn to appreciate the compelling beauty and power of words, virtues less apparent in businesslike prose and more accessible in the imaginative literature of our literary canon, we may find ourselves unable to build the shining monuments of Zion that can only exist through stories, through poetry and drama. Brigham Young said that if he were placed on a cannibal island and given the task of civilizing the natives, he would, quote, straightway build a theater for that purpose. I think it's doubtful that he would leave the task to last when building Zion. If to this point I have made it sound as though literature should, desert-like, blossom like a rose, I've certainly been avoiding the thorns of that rosebush, the problems with literature I alluded to at the beginning, issues such as the apparently immoral nature of so much of the world's reading material, or the very sticky problem of how virtue and loveliness-seeking Mormons could go about representing evil in fiction. Shouldn't we be avoiding rather than pursuing worldly literature? And if we are to create a literary tradition of our own, shouldn't it be a safer, sanitized version? Well, similar aspirations were expressed by Charity Lang, a character in Wallace Stegner's novel Crossing to Safety. After she, her husband, and another couple had surveyed much of the world's great art in the famous museums of Florence, Italy, the four discussed the frustrating fact that the wicked and unhappy always steal the show in art. Milton's Paradise Regained, for example, has Christ as its hero, but it is Paradise Lost, featuring Satan, that is most interesting and most read. Similarly, readers yawn through Dante's Paradise, but they eat up his Inferno, with all its nasty details of hell. To all of this, Charity Lang objects. Of course you can make great art out of happiness and goodness, she insists, with an eye to the moral improvement she would have art perform. Art ought to set standards and provide models. It should not be conspicuous for its evil. Oh, come on, she said, sounding very much like a few Mormons I know. Why don't you just ignore all that stuff so many modern writers concentrate on and write something about a really decent, kind, good human being living a normal life in a normal community, interested in things most ordinary people are interested in, family, children, education, good, uplifting entertainment. She does kind of sound LDS to me. The narrator calls Charity's view the sundial theory of art, because, like she insisted on, counting no hours but the sunny ones. If Mormons are to read and write literature for the building of Zion, should they do so based on the sundial theory, only approving or creating the art that counts the happy hours? I think some of the fiction that's published for the Mormon market is written on that basis. As the Morgans and the Langs continue their tour of Italy, they have a chance to test their views. They witness the artwork of Piero della Francesca, including his striking depiction of the resurrected Christ and the drunken soldiers set to watch him. Until then, Larry Morgan, the narrator, explains, there had been a good deal of frivolity among us, a springtime response to the blossoms and the mild, clear air. But Piero's Christ knocked it out of us like an elbow in the solar plexus. That gloomy, stricken face permitted no forgetful high spirits. It was not the face of a god reclaiming his suspended immortality, but the face of a man who until a moment ago had been thoroughly and horribly dead, and still had the smell of death in his clothes and the terror of death in his mind. If resurrection had taken place, it had not yet been comprehended. Now, Charity claims that this painting is another instance of an artist resorting to shock for his effects. Instead of trying to paint the joy, the beauty, the wonder that would naturally accompany the triumph over death, an uplifting idea if there ever was one, Piero had chosen to do it backwards, upside down. She thought he was, this is referring to Charity, she thought he was anti-human, the artist, in his scornful portraits of the drunken soldiers, and anti-God in his portrait of Christ. Instead of showing pity for human suffering, the painting insisted on grinding down on the shocking details. Close quote. Charity makes a good case, and her indictment of Piero could hold for so much of what goes as art in the world. It sensationalizes evil at the expense of the good that could be portrayed. What Charity does not notice, however, is how Sally Morgan, the woman of the other couple, who has had no use of her legs since an attack of polio robbed her of her rosiest future, is staring soberly at Piero's Jesus, quote, with something like recognition or acknowledgement in her eyes, as if those who have been dead understand things that will never be understood by those who have only lived. Later, as the foursome is riding in their car back to town, they come across an accident in which an Italian laborer has had his hand horribly crushed. They are enlisted to take them to his village, but are frustrated when he will not allow them to see to his medical needs. The scent of blossoms and springtime that had drifted into their car was replaced by the scents of blood and garlic that came from the dirty man who stoically held the pain in as he stared at the changed future in his useless hand. The four visitors became sobered. As Sally and Larry returned to their apartment, Larry asked his crippled wife, "When you remember today, what will you remember best, the spring countryside and the company of our friends, or Piero's Christ and that workman with the mangled hand?" "All of it," she responds. "It wouldn't be complete or real if you left out any part of it, would it?" This is Stegner's answer to the facile but lopsided sundial theory of art, a response that is marvelously illustrated in the overall story of this novel. This book tells of the close friendship of two couples, but does not shirk from describing the anguish and frustration they encountered as Sally faces a life of incapacity as a polio victim, and as later Charity contracts terminal cancer, or when Larry and Sid each find the ambitions of their early careers are frustrated by the realities of their wives' conditions and personalities, despite their great love for their spouses. The novel is poignant in its portrait of friendship and endurance. People suffer, they do not get what they want, sometimes friends and spouses hurt one another, and the book has no real happy ending. But the experience of the book is something like Sally Morgan's experience as she stared into the sad eyes of Piero's resurrected Christ. We feel more and know more by sensing the experience of others who suffer but persist. Stegner could have written a novel in which Larry somehow achieved the literary fame he was headed for despite his wife's disability, or a story in which the overpowering personality of Charity did not hamper the academic career of her husband, Sid. Instead, Stegner allowed those obstacles to be real for those characters. Their hours were not only the sunny ones. But our interest is sustained, our sympathies engaged by the persistence of their love for one another as friends and as mates as they wade through their darkest times. This is a novel that is virtuous, lovely, and of good report, not for ignoring the unvirtuous, the unlovely, or even the evil, but for treating these real elements of life in a way that leads to our finding deepened reasons for our commitments to friends and to spouses. It does better than reflect the sunny hours. This novel brings us ways to negotiate the midnight ones. Before Mormons can profit from the study or the production of literature, they must have a theoretical basis that justifies these endeavors, a way to understand what they're doing. The vision of Zion that I talked of earlier is a stirring beginning and a lofty goal, but the enterprise of literature will only prosper among the saints if a tradition of Mormon criticism accompanies the rise of Mormon literature. Why? Well, just as I have used Wallace Stegner's novel to illustrate the virtue and necessity of not effacing the dark parts of life from our depictions of it, so other Mormon critics will need to interpret the world's literature to our people, speaking in terms Mormons understand, addressing their legitimate objections, and discussing the merits that they find. Literature, like the spiritual life that we preach to the world, has the power of transformation available in it. But for those who write it, both for those who write it and those who read it. But this is not always immediately apparent, especially when Mormons are so good at pointing out the red flags of sin in attempts to illustrate reality. Should we automatically shun the depictions of immorality either in our own writing or in the world's? This would be inconsistent with the kind of engagement with ideas to which we have been encouraged since the very beginning of Mormonism. Early leaders of the church made specific statements regarding the nature of critical discourse and its relationship to learning and literature that we should be reminded of. Joseph Smith and Brigham Young both encouraged vigorous verbal explorations of the truth. From Liberty Jail, Joseph said, "How vain and trifling have been our spirits, our conferences, our councils, our meetings, our private as well as public conversations. Too low, too mean, too vulgar, too condescending for the dignified characters of the called and chosen of God." Hugh Nibley clarifies Joseph's meaning of condescending, settling for inferior goods to avoid effort and tension. Such intellectual cowardice Brother Brigham could not abide. With typical verve, he affirmed, "Diffidence or timidity we must dispense with. When it becomes our duty to talk, we ought to be willing to talk. When we interchanging our ideas and exhibiting that which we believe and understand affords an opportunity for detecting and correcting errors." In Nibley's gloss of Brigham, "The expanding mind must be openly and frankly critical, come hell or high council." Because I have taken very seriously the power available to change hearts and minds that we find in literature, and because I realize how complicated and vexing it can be to distinguish good from bad in the worlds of art and entertainment, I have begun a new journal called Mormon Review. Its intent is to help Mormons become better readers and better viewers, enriching their experiences with art and popular media as well as literature. Ultimately, the goal is to move along the cause of Zion, to enlist the arts and media in the service of the Restoration, not just for the missionary purposes, but for the experiences the saints can have as the reading of literature helps them become better people. We hope to provide a forum for the variety of Mormon perspectives on books and media, to inform the Mormon public of what is being produced by Mormon publishers and artists, and to supply the sort of constructive critical environment that will foster better Mormon productions and better appreciation of LDS and non-LDS arts and entertainment generally. I hope you don't believe that my intentions here have been purely commercial, however much I would like each and every one of you to subscribe to Mormon Review. I sincerely believe that our vision of a Zion people will be incomplete without a deepened appreciation for the arts and for literature specifically. And unless we have many means for addressing art, literature, and the media from Mormon perspectives and in LDS terms, we will find ourselves unprepared to appreciate or to build the beauties of Zion that have been promised to us. Thanks.
When I was introduced, Marianne said, "I have been a professor at BYU. I hope she doesn't know something I don't know. But at any rate, I read this essay and now heard it with pleasure and excitement. I remember sitting in our car under a tree in Kianta, Arizona, while I was on my mission, listening to General Conference. And I've planted President Kimball, well, then Apostle Kimball's talk on Zion, what Zion means, into that setting. I think he actually wrote the talk much earlier than that, but I've hooked those two experiences together. And just reading this essay brought back to me the excitement of the possibility of Zion, which is alive to me, and was brought again alive by this essay. As you probably have, I too thought of it as mainly spiritual and economic, but not necessarily cultural or civilizing. And I appreciate this essay for pointing us in that direction. But then I started thinking about some of the things that my great-grandparents wrote in their journals and in letters. And this was alive to them, too. My great-grandmother, Esther Ann Birch, great-great-grandmother, in Wales, taught herself to read by reading the newspapers pasted to the walls of the outhouse, which she, you know, they put them up there for insulation. And when her employer found out what she was doing, he started turning the newspapers upside down, but she still persisted. She still kept after it, learning how to read with this upside-down newspapers in the outhouse. She had such a love of writing. The things that Gideon has described in this essay were alive to her as well. And then she wanted to learn to write, and she copied her brother-in-law, who had been more educated than she was. She taught her son, and I think that this is a metaphor that Gideon sets, not the metaphor, but he sets up a division between popular and scholarly kinds of writing, and church proselyting kinds of writing and scholarly writing. Well, my great-grandfather, when he would ride out to the sheep herds, he'd have a Bible in one saddlebag and a complete edition of Shakespeare in the other saddlebag. So this love of broad spectrum of literature was alive to them. And his family, my relatives have told me about his household, where in the evenings they'd read and talk to each other about literature and plays and so forth. I'm especially excited in Burton's essay about his ignoring or trying to bring together the split that I've just talked about, the split between critical and proselyting or missionary kinds of literature, trying to bring that split together. And we could name the split in many other terms. People who write about the current troubles at BYU have talked about the split. And I think this essay does something to heal that split. It talks about cultural literature, not just critical or popular. It's a healing essay. And if we followed the things that he's described in this essay, it would be a healing process. The process of using literature as learning and as civilizing, as a blossoming thing, would be very important. Many of the students I taught have needed this, and I think that this idea of pushing serious considerative literature to a general audience is important. I've had one student who, after we read Benediction, had the idea that Kevin Houston, who is the one who's believes in heaven as kind of a pyramid scheme and portrays Peter as kind of a Rambo, not Rambo, but the boxer. What's the boxer's name? Rocky. Peter is like Rocky, an all-American hero. And the student believed, didn't read the sarcasm at all, the satire in the essay at all, the story. She read that man as the hero and Damon Boulder as the one who was brought around to that kind of thinking when he chants as the closing prayer, "Give me an R, give me an O, give me a C, K, Y." She thought that he was being converted to Kevin Houston's cause. She needs to be taught to read. And hopefully this kind of process would teach her to read. I had students who misread things constantly because of the lack of this kind of critical thing that Gideon is promoting. Well, my main response to this essay, and I just have a few more comments, is that this kind of a review, the Mormon review, would help immensely. Not aimed at the scholarly audience, not aimed at the lowest level of the popular audience, but a bridge that builds between those two groups. I think it's an exciting project. And as I wrote these questions, his essay felt to me like a seed, had contained many seeds of other essays. And I suppose that the Mormon Review would contain these essays that would answer some of my questions. One question I have is of the relationship of these two kinds of literature throughout history, proselyting versus critical. Implies that in Orson Whitney's time, this was an alive thing to them. Now it's degenerated to an occasional roadshow. Maybe in some stakes it's different. I'm excited about the prospect of it being more than that, more than an occasional roadshow, and those have died out too. But in, traditionally, historically, what has been the relationship? Has this serious consideration of literature as a civilizing and cultural influence, has it declined? Why? Maybe it hasn't declined. I'm interested in that essay. Was there a genuine love for literature in the previous century? Gideon also suggests that this kind of literature, the popular proselyting kind, has certain dangers. I'd like to read an essay which describes those dangers for a lay audience. It's been written for a serious scholarly audience, but not for a lay audience. And I would like to see that essay. I'd like to see what the dangers and strengths are of both kinds. The dangers and strengths of the kind of hardcore doubting stories which are in my book. What are the strengths, in layman's terms, of the critically sound realistic literature? How does it help us navigate the midnight hours? How does it help us navigate the midnight hours, in layman's terms? I'd like to read an essay, something like Matthew Arnold's, The Importance of Criticism at the Present Time, which articulates for Mormon laymen why this kind of thinking is important. And then I'd like to read an essay which draws that into question. I had a rude awakening when I went to my doctor's degree. I had the idea that reading literature would make everyone compassionate, open, unbiased, considerate. And some of the worst, narrowest, most inflexible people I know were English professors. And that tradition, in my experience, has continued on. With every university I've been to, except one possibly, BYU Hawaii, there's that kind of narrow bitterness in the English department. Why? Why can that happen, that someone can read literature and not be civilized by it? How can that happen? I'd like to read an essay considering that question. How is it that great art has a civilizing influence? Part of the answer may be the kind of balance that I learned, hopefully, from my great-grandfather, where he had Shakespeare in one bag and the Bible in the other, combining a liberalizing influence with a scholarly influence, with a Christianizing influence. Most of these essays that I've questions that I've asked would be answered in this review that he's promoted, and I don't think that this is a bad place to promote that review. He apologized at the end of his essay, but I think it's an excellent prospect to see a popular, serious critical consideration of popular media. It's what I think that's essential and important. I think we could do other things as well in order, as he said, to chart the middle ground between academic and scholarly. I think that we could do things to heal this split that I've been talking about. We need readers who write. We need readers who pray, writers who pray. Maybe somehow a feeling of gratitude, as is described in the end of the Book of Mormon, as an influence as we read. A feeling of gratitude to God would help us read with a Christian scholarly viewpoint. Classes in Mormon literature, I think, can help. Books which bridge the gap, such as Orson Scott Card's new book, The Lost Son, Lost Boys, it is. And Margaret Young's Salvador, I think, are neither Deseret Book Products nor Signature Book Products. There's something in the middle. I think all of these kinds of things could help set up a tradition which would heal this split by putting a Christian influence in one part of our minds and a scholarly critical influence in the other part of our minds. And so I appreciated reading this essay and hearing it.
Thank you very much, both of you. I think that there were some extremely stimulating ideas in these papers, and I hope that we have 20 minutes, I believe, that we can have some questions and comments. So as you answer, would you please reframe the question for the benefit of the tape? Yes, please.
The question is, we have this patriarchal blessing, Milton's and Shakespeare's of our own, and why don't we have them yet? If you go into your local Deseret bookstore and you ask for a copy of Milton, you won't find it. As a matter of fact, I asked them to call it up on their computer, and they've never had it. They did have a Shakespeare volume that looked like more for the shelf than for reading. That's part of the problem. Before we have great writers, we have to have great readers. That's why my whole emphasis is on building a more critical Mormon culture. Until we can appreciate the world's literature and at the same time appreciate the value of our Mormon insights to that literature, we'll never be able to make a new literature that is as grand as is described there. Sometimes people have, we want a great literature sometimes for the wrong reasons. We want a Milton and Shakespeare because Milton and Shakespeare are famous, but we don't take the time to read Milton and Shakespeare and see that they're very challenging and the ideas that they have, very complex, and that they invite us to think about our lives and change our lives in important ways. Part of it, I think, is the Mormon envy for popularity. It's the Dale Murphy syndrome sort of thing. It's somebody famous that we can latch on to. Let's do it. That's one of my responses. Do you have something?
One other response that I have, and I wish I could remember who wrote this. I think it may have been Carl Keller.
He said that part of the problem is that either someone is so far in the church that they can't... Again, it's a healing of these two extremes, I think, which would produce a Shakespeare or the ground. It says if either someone's so in the church that they can't create a mythical structure which would bring any part of that into question, or they're so far out of the church that they can't find in the church and the structure of Mormon culture any value that they would want to put into literature. And so neither Shakespeare or Milton can be described that way. They were fully in their cultures and they fully questioned their cultures. And so that's one of my responses.
In the back there. The question is, perhaps it's a problem of the fear of creativity and who knows what may occur if people start being really individualistic and original in how they conceive of things. Perhaps, you might have an uncorrelated thought, something like that. And also the problem of not having good examples for young Mormons as they grow up. Did you want to comment on that?
I just wanted to comment on the review.
Oh, we are. That's only a list of the manuscripts we have in hand, not the ones that are on the way. We are doing Hannah, the No-Cow Wife, which is a new title.
I said there's so much really good children's literature that it ought to be.
Well, we're not reviewing just the things that are successful here. I mean, notice, for example, Secret Ceremonies is on there, a very controversial book, and it tells all about the temple ceremony. It's a terrible book.
It's a terrible book.
And it needs to be... we need to have a response for it. But other things, it's a matter of helping people simply sort things out. Like there's a lot of popularity now with these after-death experiences, these near-death experiences. You've all seen Betty Eady's book, Embraced by the Light, and there's a new title coming out from Deseret Book by Brent Topp and his wife, I believe, called Beyond Death's Door. We're reviewing both of those as a way of sort of asking, well, from a Mormon perspective, which one of these works according to our doctrine? And... Well, we're walking a tightrope because we want to give substantial reviews that really appreciate it on the grounds of solid critical standards. But at the same time, Mormon critical standards are sort of vague and being formed right now. They're in code. I mean, on one level, one woman wrote to me and said, oh, I'd love to review this movie for you. And now, I guess because you want a Mormon perspective, you want me to tell you all the bad things in it. The nudity and the violence and so on like that. Well, I believe we do need to come to terms with things like nudity and violence. But that seemed to me a little bit facile the way she did that. It's like, aren't there more important things to look for than the bad things? That's a first step in Mormon criticism is let's get out of the mode of only identifying things that could be a threat to ourselves and our children. We need to be aware of those, of course, but we need to look for example, the way a film could or a book or something could succeed for us despite an apparent, on the surface, it wouldn't go along with Mormon culture. For example, one of our reviews for the first issue is on the straight edge punk movement. Now, many of you may not follow. I didn't. It's a whole, the whole movement of the punk movement is rebellion. It's just anti. The music is loud and fast. I find it personally very annoying. But it is popular among many of the youth, and it's all about rebellion. Well, there's this group of punk rockers called the Straight Edge Movement. And what are they rebelling against? They're rebelling against the other punkers and their dependence on drugs and sex and alcohol. And so they are, the title of our review is Obscene But Clean. They have a lot of profanity in their lyrics, but their songs are all about rejecting alcohol, rejecting drugs, rejecting sex. They're all celibate. It's an amazing thing. So part of it is finding good in places you wouldn't expect it. Yeah, and it's not, I mean, sometimes... She's hoping that we don't ignore literature beyond what's produced by Mormons as being very important to Mormons. Is that right? Many people find that, and they come to me with these books that they've read that they're excited about, and so that's why the standard for the Mormon Review is we're reviewing not just stuff that is marketed to the Mormon market or written by Mormons, but things that are of interest to Mormons, and Mormons have very broad interests. So, I agree.
There's another. I'm going to push another title in here, which is. She Needed Me by Walter Kern, and he's in or out of the church, I don't know what, it doesn't matter to me, but he's, the story is, the first line of the story says, I met her on the doorstep of, something like this, I met her on the doorstep of the clinic, and it's an it's an abortion clinic, and he's an anti-abortion protester, and she's coming in to get an abortion. That's how they meet. And then the story is, she's pregnant, and the story is the working out of their very compassionate relationship with each other. And it's a wonderful, serious examination of what to think about abortion. Really an important book.
Yes?
One of my concerns is as you move in.
Okay. She's mentioning there's a sort of... middle ground of literature that's being produced or written but not published that may be controversial, that Mormon... market may not be ready for, but a national market wouldn't be appropriate for, and how can we bring those things to light in a healthy way? Did you want to comment on that?
I'd like to speak to that. Guts.
I'm glad you brought up Chaim Potok, because he is an important figure for sort of paving the way, showing how someone who is thoroughly committed to a religious system can find ways to make that whole religious value system and the whole dramas that go on within that be very important and relevant for a national audience. He's a good model for us. I heard him speak at the University of Utah in 1983, and he was asked the same question you asked me earlier. He said, someone asked him, when is there going to be a great Mormon novel? And he said, well, it'll be when someone writes it from within the core of your culture. You can't have outsiders writing a great Mormon novel. And I would add to that, it also will happen when people find ways of making Mormonism relevant to non-Mormons in terms other than their potential membership of the church. Okay, for example, our unique perspective on physicality and matter is a wonderful concept. To me, it lends great dignity to poetry and our efforts to grasp with language in its very concrete terms. And Joseph Smith makes comments about language that are really interesting and would be interesting to writers generally. And we could make the basis of a very interesting literary theory based on Mormon theology and statements about materialism and so on. But, you know, if we weren't looking to see how many we could get to join the church by way of that, you know what I mean? So a lot of it is finding ways to make Mormonism relevant to non-Mormons without it always being in light of, and that way we'll get them into the church. I mean, that comes along with it. People will get interest in the church as they find that Mormons have interesting stories to tell. That's true. I mean, hopefully our journal will be a forum for introducing less-known works that are important to a broad public. Yeah, Deborah objects to the whole idea of having Miltons and Shakespeares of our own, that perhaps we'd do better to look at not where's our great Mormon novel, but what is good that's there. And I think that's really true. There are a lot of lesser-known novels and Mormon writers that have not been... people have not been familiarized with them. Last year at Sunstone... I heard a woman say in response to a very interesting session sponsored by the Association for Mormon Letters, where Mormon writers were talking about their work. She raised her hand and she said, "Where is all of this stuff? I didn't know that there was Mormon literature here and there." And that's partly why we were founding Mormon Review. I mean, it's like, for one thing, we'll tell you what's there, both the very popular and some the more high quality. They can go together too, I guess. Oh, by the way, I've meant to mention Orson Scott Card in this regard. Orson Scott Card is a real model, I think, of the attempt to try to make a popular literature, popular not just among Mormons, but among a national audience, but also stuff that engages Mormon issues and draws upon the Mormon culture. You may have read him, I don't know. He sometimes doesn't please every Mormon in the way that he represents the church, but would anyone? I challenge you, go to see the film Legacy, the Joseph Smith Memorial Building, and will everyone in there go, "Yes, that's just the way I thought Joseph Smith should be"? It's not going to happen. You won't please the whole church. But anyway, he's written I'm going to give a plug for his new book. It's called A Storyteller in Zion. And if you've been interested in some of these issues that have come up, this is a compilation of his criticism that he's written for Sunstone, for in many other places, some speeches that he's given, that brings up many of these ideas of the role of literature in building Zion. And he, for example, one of my favorite essays is The Problem of Evil in Fiction, where he deals with this problem. It is a very difficult one. Especially with movies, we are more sensitive to it there. Could it be that there's actually a very violent movie or a movie with nudity in it that might actually be very edifying and important for us? So, any other questions? It got a Pulitzer Prize, but that's not awarded by the Mormons, is it? Yeah, that was really unfortunate. I really appreciate that. He's commenting on how much TV is part of contemporary life, and shouldn't we emphasize literature more?
In fact, I'd like to know. You've got a couple of young kids. I'd kind of like to know what your plans are for your children.
We're going to talk about the TV they watch. Your comment?
In growing up in the church, I press.
The church has moved away from many of the has backed away from some of these sort of cultural improvement sorts of things. Like cultural refinement has dropped out of Relief Society, which I was really sad by because I always read my mother's Relief Society manual. That's right. And part of that is, you know, the church is streamlining and it's trying to leave a little more flexibility to the local areas to do what they want. And I actually think that's positive in the long run because when it comes down to it, I think we can do more in these regards through private means and through a church-sponsored thing. There's so many problems with a church-sponsored literary or cultural endeavor because, you know, it has to meet the standards of a correlation committee. And, you know, literature thrives on controversy. And I don't think controversy is the end. I feel it's the way we work through our human problems, and we do that in a spirit of friendly, critical analysis, but you can't do that from the church.
This is an interesting symbol.
Perhaps. I don't know who was next.
The local wars aren't picking up. Nothing to replace them.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, what's taking the place of the cultural refinement lessons? Well, good, and you tell me about it, and we'll feature them in Mormon Review. Okay, I guess we're running out of time. Oh, we did in the Los Angeles stake recently. Oh, I agree.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid we're going to have to cut it off. I'm sorry to do that, but thank you for your participation and for these excellent papers. Gideon does have a little brochure on this if you're interested. I am very excited by the possibility of divergent criticism and exposure.